3. Clean hands.
The most unpleasant thing about human beings is that they don't metamorphose. Your people and mine are born as grubs, but we transform ourselves into a higher form before we reproduce. Human beings remain grubs all their lives.
Human beings do metamorphose. They change their identity constantly. However, each new identity thrives on the delusion that it was always in possession of the body it has just conquered.
Such changes are superficial. The nature of the organism remains the same. Humans are very proud of their changes, but every imagined transformation turns out to be a new set of excuses for behaving exactly as the individual has always behaved.
You are too different from humans ever to understand them.
You are too similar to humans for you ever to be able to see them clearly.
The gods first spoke to Han Qingzhao when she was 7 years old. She didn't realize for a while that she was hearing the voice of a god. All she knew was that her hands were filthy, covered with some loathsome invisible slime, and she had to purify them. The first few times a simple washing was enough, and she felt better for days. But as time passed, the feeling of filthiness returned sooner each time, and it took more and more scrubbing to remove the dirt, until she was washing several times a day, using a hard bristled brush to stab at her hands until they bled. Only when the pain was unbearable did she feel clean, and then only for a few hours at a time. She told no one. She knew instinctively that the filthiness of her hands had to be kept secret. Everyone knew that hand washing was one of the first signs that the gods were speaking to a child, and most parents in the whole world of Path watched their children hopefully for signs of excessive concern with cleanliness. But what these people did not understand was the terrible self-knowledge that led to the washing. The first message from the gods was of the unspeakable filthiness of the one they spoke to. Qingzhao hid her hand washing. Not because she was ashamed that the gods spoke to her, but because she was sure that if anyone knew how vile she was, they would despise her. The gods conspired with her in concealment. They allowed her to confine her savage scrubbing to the palms of her hands. This meant that when her hands were badly hurt, she could clench them into fists, or tuck them into the folds of her skirt as she walked, or lay them in her lap very meekly when she sat, and no one would notice them. They saw only a very well-behaved little girl. If her mother had been alive, Qingzhao's secret would have been discovered much sooner. As it was, it took months for a servant to notice. Fat old Mu Bao happened to notice a bloody stain on the small tablecloth from Qingzhao's breakfast table. Mu Bao knew at once what it meant. Weren't bloody hands well known to be an early sign of the god's attention? That was why many an ambitious mother and father forced a particularly promising child to wash and wash. Throughout the world of Path, ostentatious hand-washing was called inviting the gods. Mu Bao went at once to Qingzhao's father, the noble Han Feizi, rumored to be the greatest of the gods spoken, one of the few so powerful in the eyes of the gods that he could meet with framlings, off-worlders, and never betray a hint of the voices of the gods within him, thus preserving the divine secret of the world of Path. He would be grateful to hear the news, and Mu Bao would be honored for having been the first to see the gods in Qingzhao. Within an hour, Han Feizi had gathered up his beloved little Qingzhao, and together they rode in a sedan chair to the temple at Rockfall. Qingzhao didn't like riding in such chairs. She felt bad for the men who had to carry their weight. They don't suffer, Father told her the first time she mentioned this idea. They feel greatly honored. It is one of the ways the people show honor to the gods. When one of the gods spoken goes to a temple, he does it on the shoulders of the people of Path. But I am getting bigger every day, Qingzhao answered. When you're too big, either you'll walk on your own feet, or you'll ride in your own chair, said Father. He did not need to explain that she would have her own chair only if she grew up to be God-spoken herself. And we try to show our humility by remaining very thin and light, so we aren't a heavy burden to the people. This was a joke, of course, since Father's belly, while not immense, was copious. But the lesson behind the joke was true. The God spoken must never be a burden to the common people of Path. The people must always be grateful, never resentful, that the gods had chosen their world of all worlds to hear their voices. Now, though, Ching Zhao was more concerned with the ordeal that lay before her. She knew that she was being taken for testing. Many children are taught to pretend that the gods speak to them, Father explained. We must find out if the gods have truly chosen you. I want them to stop choosing me, said Ching Zhao. And you will want it even more during the test, said Father. His voice was filled with pity. It made Ching Zhao even more afraid. The folks see only our powers and privileges and envy us. They don't know the great suffering of those who hear the voices of the gods. If the gods truly speak to you, my Ching Zhao, you will learn to bear the suffering the way jade bears the carver's knife, the polisher's rough cloth. It will make you shine. Why else do you think I named you Ching Zhao? Ching Zhao, gloriously bright, was what the name meant. It was also the name of a great poet from ancient times in old China, a woman poet in an age when only men were given respect, and yet she was honored as the greatest of poets in her day. Thin fog and thick cloud, gloom all day. It was the opening of Li Qingzhao's song, The Double Ninth. That was how Qingzhao felt now. And how did the poem end? Now my curtains lifted only by the western wind, I've grown thinner than this golden blossom. Would this be her ending also? Was her ancestor of the heart telling her in this poem that the darkness falling over her now would be lifted only when the gods came out of the west to lift her thin, light, golden soul out of her body? It was too terrible to think of death now, when she was only 7 years old. And yet the thought came to her, if I die soon, then soon I'll see mother, and even the great Li Qingzhao herself. But the test had nothing to do with death, or at least it was not supposed to. It was quite simple, really. Father led her into a large room where three old men knelt, or they seemed like men. They could have been women. They were so old that all distinctions had disappeared. They had only the tiniest wisps of white hair and no beards at all, and they dressed in shapeless sacks. Later, Ching Zhao would learn that these were temple eunuchs, survivors of the old days before Starway's Congress intervened and forbade even voluntary self-mutilation in the service of a religion. Now, though, they were mysterious, ghostly old creatures whose hands touched her, exploring her clothing. What were they searching for? They found her ebony chopsticks and took them away. They took the sash from around her waist. They took her slippers. Later, she would learn that these things were taken because other children had become so desperate during their testing that they had killed themselves. One of them had inserted her chopsticks into her nostrils and then flung herself to the floor, jamming the sticks into her brain. Another had hanged herself with her sash. Another had forced her slippers into her mouth and down her throat, choking herself to death. Successful suicide attempts were rare, but they seemed to happen with the brightest of the children, and most commonly with girls. So they took away from Ching Zhao all the known ways of committing suicide. The old ones left. Father knelt beside Ching Zhao and spoke to her face to face. You must understand, Ching Zhao, that we are not really testing you. Nothing that you do of your own free will can make the slightest difference in what happens here. We are really testing the gods to see if they are determined to speak to you. If they are, they'll find a way, and we'll see it, and you'll come out of this room as one of the gods spoken. If they aren't, then you'll come out of here free of their voices for all time. I can't tell you which outcome I pray for, since I don't know myself. Father, said Ching Zhao, what if you're ashamed of me? The very thought made her feel a tingling in her hands, as if there were dirt on them, as if she needed to wash them. I will not be ashamed of you either way. Then he clapped his hands. One of the old ones came back in, bearing a heavy basin. He set it down before Ching Zhao. Thrust in your hands, said Father. The basin was filled with thick, black grease. Ching Zhao shuddered. I can't put my hands in there. Father reached out, took her by the forearms, and forced her hands down into the muck. Ching Zhao cried out. Her father had never used force with her before. And when he let go of her arms, her hands were covered with clammy slime. She gasped at the filthiness of her hands. It was hard to breathe, looking at them like that, smelling them. The old one picked up the basin and carried it out. Where can I wash, Father? Ching Zhao whimpered. You can't wash, said Father. You can never wash again. And because Ching Zhao was a child, she believed him, not guessing that his words were part of the test. She watched Father leave the room. She heard the door latch behind him. She was alone. At first, she simply held her hands out in front of her, making sure they didn't touch any part of her clothing. She searched desperately for somewhere to wash, but there was no water, nor even a cloth. The room was far from bare. There were chairs, tables, statues, large stone jars, but all the surfaces were hard and well-polished and so clean that she couldn't bear to touch them. Yet the filthiness of her hands was unendurable. She had to get them clean. Father, she called out. Come and wash my hands. Surely he could hear her. Surely he was somewhere near, waiting for the outcome of her test. He must hear her. But he didn't come. The only cloth in the room was the gown she was wearing. She could wipe on that, only then she would be wearing the grease. It might get on other parts of her body. The solution, of course, was to take it off. But how could she do that without touching her filthy hands to some other part of herself? She tried. First, she carefully scraped off as much of the grease as she could on the smooth arms of a statue. Forgive me, she said to the statue, in case it belonged to a god. I will come and clean you after. I'll clean you with my own gown. Then she reached back over her shoulders and gathered the cloth on her back, pulling up on the gown to draw it over her head. Her greasy fingers slipped on the silk. She could feel the slime cold on her bare back as it penetrated the silk. I'll clean it after, she thought. At last she got a firm enough grasp of the fabric that she could pull off the gown. It slid over her head, but even before it was completely off, she knew that things were worse than ever, for some of the grease was in her long hair, and that hair had fallen onto her face, and now she had filth not just on her hands, but also on her back, in her hair, on her face. Still, she tried. She got the gown the rest of the way off, then carefully wiped her hands on one small part of the fabric. Then she wiped her face on another, but it was no good. Some of the grease clung to her no matter what she did. Her face felt as if the silk of her gown had only smeared the grease around instead of lifting it away. She had never been so hopelessly grimy in her life. It was unbearable, and yet she couldn't get rid of it. Father! Come, take me away. I don't want to be Godspoken. He didn't come. She began to cry. The trouble with crying was that it didn't work. The more she cried, the filthier she felt. The desperate need to be clean overpowered even her weeping. So, with tears streaming down her face, she began to search desperately for some way to get the grease off her hands. Again, she tried the silk of her gown. But within a little while, she was wiping her hands on the walls, sidling around the room, smearing them with grease. She rubbed her palms on the wall so rapidly that heat built up and the grease melted. She did it again and again, until her hands were red, until some of the softened scabs on her palms had worn away or been torn off by invisible snags in the wooden walls. When her palms and fingers hurt badly enough that she couldn't feel the slime on them, she wiped her face with them, gouged at her face with her fingernails to scrape away the grease there. Then, hands dirty again, she once more rubbed them on the walls. Finally, Exhausted, she fell to the floor and wept at the pain in her hands, at her helplessness to get clean. Her eyes were shut with weeping. Tears streaked down her cheeks. She rubbed at her eyes, at her cheeks, and felt how slimy the tears made her skin, how filthy she was. She knew what this surely meant. The gods had judged her and found her unclean. She wasn't worthy to live. If she couldn't get clean, she had to blot herself out. That would satisfy them. That would ease the agony of it. All she had to do was find a way to die, to stop breathing. Father would be sorry he didn't come when she called to him, but she couldn't help that. She was under the power of the gods now, and they had judged her unworthy to be among the living. After all, what right did she have to breathe when the gate of Mother's lips had stopped letting the air pass through, in or out, for all these many years? She first thought of using her gown, thought of stuffing it into her mouth to block her breath, or tying it around her throat to choke herself, but it was too filthy to handle, too covered with grease. She would have to find another way. Qing Zhao walked to the wall, pressed against it, sturdy wood. She leaned back and flung her head against the wood. Pain flashed through her head when it struck. Stunned, she dropped to a sitting position on the floor. Her head ached inside. The room swung slowly around and around her. For a moment, she forgot the filthiness of her hands. But the relief didn't last long. She could see on the wall a slightly duller place where the grease from her forehead broke up the shiny, polished surface. The gods spoke inside her, insisted she was as filthy as ever. A little pain wouldn't make up for her unworthiness. Again, she struck her head against the wall. This time, however, there was nowhere near as much pain. Again, again, and now she realized that against her will, her body was recoiling from the blow, refusing to inflict so much pain on herself. This helped her understand why the gods found her so unworthy. She was too weak to make her body obey. Well, she wasn't helpless. She could fool her body into submission. She selected the tallest of the statues, which stood perhaps 3 meters high. It was a bronze casting of a man in mid-stride, holding a sword above his head. There were enough angles and bends and projections that she could climb. Her hands kept slipping, but she persevered until she balanced on the statue's shoulders, holding onto its headdress with one hand and the sword with the other. For a moment, touching the sword, she thought of trying to cut her throat on it. That would stop her breath, wouldn't it? But the blade was only a pretend blade. It wasn't sharp, and she couldn't get her neck to it at the right angle. So she went back to her original plan. She took several deep breaths, then clasped her hands behind her back and toppled forward. She would land on her head, and that would end her filthiness. As the floor rushed upward, however, she lost control of herself. She screamed. She felt her hands tear free of each other behind her back and rush forward to try to break her fall. Too late, she thought with grim satisfaction. And then her head struck the floor, and everything went black. Qing Zhao awoke with a dull ache in her arm and a sharp pain in her head whenever she moved. But she was alive. When she could bear to open her eyes, she saw that the room was darker. Was it night outside? How long had she slept? She couldn't bear to move her left arm, the one with the pain. She could see an ugly red bruise at the elbow, and she thought she must have broken it inside when she fell. She also saw that her hands were still smeared with grease and felt her unbearable dirtiness, the god's judgment against her. She shouldn't have tried to kill herself after all. The gods wouldn't allow her to escape their judgment so easily. What can I do? She pleaded. How can I be clean before you, O gods? Li Jingzhao, my ancestor of the heart, show me how to make myself worthy to receive the kind judgment of the gods. What came at once to her mind was Li Jingzhao's love song, Separation. It was one of the first that father had given her to memorize when she was only 3 years old. Only a short time before he and mother told her that mother was going to die. It was exactly appropriate now, too, for wasn't she separated from the goodwill of the gods? Didn't she need to be reconciled with them so they could receive her as one of the truly God-spoken ones? Someone sent a loving note in lines of returning geese, and as the moon fills my western chamber, as petals dance over the flowing stream, again I think of you, the two of us, living a sadness apart, a hurt that can't be removed. Yet when my gaze comes down, my heart stays up. The moon filling the western chamber told her that it was really a god, not an ordinary man-lover who was being pined for in this poem. References to the west always meant that the gods were involved. Li Qingzhao had answered the prayer of little Han Qingzhao and sent this poem to tell her how to cure the hurt that couldn't be removed, the filthiness of her flesh. What is the loving note? Thought Qingzhao. Lines of returning geese. But there are no geese in this room. Petals dancing over a flowing stream. But there are no petals. There is no stream here. Yet when my gaze comes down, my heart stays up. That was the clue. That was the answer. She knew it. Slowly, carefully, Qingzhao rolled over onto her belly. Once, when she tried to put weight on her left hand, her elbow buckled, and an exquisite pain almost made her lose consciousness again. At last, she knelt, her head bowed, leaning on her right hand, gazing down. The poem promised that this would let her heart stay up. She felt no better, still filthy, still in pain. Looking down showed her nothing but the polished boards of the floor, the grain of the wood making rippling lines. Couldn't the wood grain also be seen as a flowing stream? She must follow these lines like the geese. She must dance over these flowing streams like a petal. That was what the promise meant. When her gaze came down, her heart would stay up. She found one particular line in the wood grain, a line of darkness like a river rippling through the lighter wood around it, and knew at once that this was the stream she was supposed to follow. She dared not touch it with her finger, filthy, unworthy finger. It had to be followed lightly, the way a goose touched the air, the way a petal touched the stream. Only her eyes could follow the line. So she began to trace the line, follow it carefully to the wall. A couple of times she moved so quickly that she lost the line, forgot which one it was, but soon she found it again, or thought she did, and followed it to the wall. Was it good enough? Were the gods satisfied? Almost, but not quite. She couldn't be sure that when her gaze slipped from the line, she had returned to the right one. Petals didn't skip from stream to stream. She had to follow the right one, along its entire length. This time, she started at the wall and bowed very low, so her eyes wouldn't be distracted even by the movement of her own right hand. She inched her way along, never letting herself so much as blink, even when her eyes burned. She knew that if she lost the grain she was following, she'd have to go back and start over. It had to be done perfectly, or it would lose all its power to cleanse her. It took forever. She did blink, but not haphazardly, by accident. When her eyes burned too much, she would bow down until her left eye was directly over the grain. Then she would close the other eye for a moment. Her right eye, relieved, she would open it, then put that eye directly over the line in the wood and close the left. This way, she was able to make it halfway across the room until the board ended, butting up against another. She wasn't sure whether that was good enough, whether it was enough to finish the board, or if she needed to find another wood grain line to follow. She made as if to get up, testing the gods, to see if they were satisfied. She half rose, felt nothing. She stood, and still she was at ease. Ah, they were satisfied. They were pleased with her. Now the grease on her skin felt like nothing more than a little oil. There was no need for washing, not at this moment, for she had found another way to cleanse herself, another way for the gods to discipline her. Slowly, she lay back on the floor, smiling, weeping softly in joy. Li Qingzhao, my ancestor of the heart, thank you for showing me the way. Now I have been joined to the gods. The separation is over. Mother, I am again connected to you, clean and worthy. White Tiger of the West, I am now pure enough to touch your fur and leave no mark of filthiness. Then hands touched her. Father's hands, picking her up. Drops of water fell onto her face, the bare skin of her body. Father's tears. You're alive, he said. My God-spoken one, my beloved, my daughter, my life. Gloriously bright, you shine on. Later, she would learn that Father had had to be tied and gagged during her test, that when she climbed the statue and made as if to press her throat against the sword, he flung himself forward with such force that his chair fell and his head struck the floor. This was regarded as a great mercy, since it meant he didn't see her terrible fall from the statue. He wept for her all the time she lay unconscious, and then, when she rose to her knees and began to trace the wood grains on the floor, he was the one who realized what it meant. Look, he whispered. The gods have given her a task. The gods are speaking to her. The others were slow to recognize it, because they had never seen anyone trace wood grain lines before. It wasn't in the catalog of voices of the gods. Door waiting, counting to multiples of five, object counting, checking for accidental murders, fingernail tearing, skin scraping, pulling out of hair, gnawing at stone, bugging out of eyes. All these were known to be penances that the gods demanded, rituals of obedience that cleansed the soul of the God-spoken so that the gods could fill their minds with wisdom. No one had ever seen wood grain tracing. Yet Father saw what she was doing, named the ritual, and added it to the catalog of voices. It would forever bear her name, Han Jingzhao, as the first to be commanded by the gods to perform this rite. It made her very special. So did her unusual resourcefulness in trying to find ways to cleanse her hands and, later, kill herself. Many had tried scraping their hands on walls, of course, and most attempted to wipe on clothes, but rubbing her hands to build up the heat of friction, that was regarded as rare and clever. And while head beating was common, climbing a statue and jumping off and landing on her head was very rare, and none who had done it before had been strong enough to keep their hands behind their back so long. The temple was all abuzz with it, and word soon spread to all the temples and paths. It was a great honor to Han Feiza, of course, that his daughter was so powerfully possessed by the gods, and the story of his near madness when she was trying to destroy herself spread just as quickly and touched many hearts. He may be the greatest of the gods spoken, they said of him, but he loves his daughter more than life. This made them love him as much as they already revered him. It was then that the people began whispering about the possible godhood of Han Feiza. He is great and strong enough that the gods will listen to him, said the people who favored him. Yet he is so affectionate that he will always love the people of the planet Path and try to do good for us. Isn't this what the god of a world ought to be? Of course, it was impossible to decide now. A man could not be chosen to be god of a village, let alone of a whole world, until he died. How could you judge what sort of god he'd be until his whole life, from beginning to end, was known? These whispers came to Jingzhao's ears many times as she grew older, and the knowledge that her father might well be chosen god of Path became one of the beacons of her life. But at the time, and forever in her memory, she remembered that his hands were the ones that carried her bruised and twisted body to the bed of healing. His eyes were the ones that dropped warm tears onto her cold skin. His voice was the one that whispered in the beautiful, passionate tones of the old language, "My beloved, my gloriously bright, never take your light from my life. Whatever happens, never harm yourself or I will surely die." 4. Jane.
So many of your people are becoming Christians, believing in the God these humans brought with them.
You don't believe in God?
The question never came up. We have always remembered how we began.
You evolved. We were created.
By a virus.
By a virus that God created in order to create us.
So you, too, are a believer?
I understand belief.
No, you desire belief.
I desire it enough to act as if I believed. Maybe that's what faith is.
Or deliberate insanity.
It turned out not to be just Valentine and Yacht who came over to Miro's ship. Pleaked also came, without invitation, and installed herself in a miserable little cubicle where there wasn't even room to stretch out completely. She was the anomaly on the voyage, not family, not crew, but a friend. Pleaked had been a student of Ender's when he was on Trondheim as a speaker for the dead. She had figured out, quite independently, that Andrew Wigan was the speaker for the dead, and that he was also the Ender Wigan. Why this brilliant young woman should have become so fixed on Ender Wigan, Valentine could not really understand. At times she thought, perhaps this is how some religions start. The founder doesn't ask for disciples. They come and force themselves upon him. In any event, Pleaked had stayed with Valentine and her family for all the years since Ender left Trondheim, tutoring the children and helping in Valentine's research, always waiting for the day that the family journeyed to be with Ender, a day that only Pleaked had known would come. So during the last half of the voyage to Lusitania, it was the four of them who traveled in Miro's ship, Valentine, Miro, Yacht, and Pleaked. Or so Valentine thought at first. It was on the third day since the rendezvous that she learned of the fifth traveler who had been with them all along. That day, as always, the four of them were gathered on the bridge. There was nowhere else to go. This was a cargo ship. Besides the bridge and the sleeping quarters, there was only a tiny galley and the toilet. All the other space was designed to hold cargo, not people, not in any kind of reasonable comfort. Valentine didn't mind the loss of privacy, though. She was slacking off now on her output of subversive essays. It was more important, she felt, to get to know Miro, and through him, Lusitania. The people there, the Pequeninos, and, most particularly, Miro's family. For Ender had married Novinia, Miro's mother. Valentine did glean much of that kind of information, of course. She couldn't have been a historian and biographer for all these years without learning how to extrapolate much from scant bits of evidence. The real prize for her had turned out to be Miro himself. He was bitter, angry, frustrated, and filled with loathing for his crippled body. But all that was understandable. His loss had happened only a few months before, and he was still trying to redefine himself. Valentine didn't worry about his future. She could see that he was very strong-willed, the kind of man who didn't easily fall apart. He would adapt and thrive. What interested her most was his thought. It was as if the confinement of his body had freed his mind. When he had first been injured, his paralysis was almost total. He had had nothing to do but lie in one place and think. Of course, much of his time had been spent brooding about his losses, his mistakes, the future he couldn't have. But he had also spent many hours thinking about the issues that busy people almost never think about. And on that third day together, that's what Valentine was trying to draw out of him. Most people don't think about it, not seriously. And you have, said Valentine. Just because I think about it doesn't mean I know anything, said Miro. She really was used to his voice now, though sometimes his speech was maddeningly slow. It took a real effort of will at times to keep from showing any sign of inattention. The nature of the universe, said Yacht. The sources of life, said Valentine. You said you had thought about what it means to be alive, and I want to know what you thought.
How the universe works and why we all are in it. Miro laughed. It's pretty crazy stuff. I've been trapped alone in an ice floe in a fishing boat for 2 weeks in a blizzard with no heat, said Yacht. I doubt you've come up with anything that'll sound crazy to me.
Valentine smiled. Yacht was no scholar, and his philosophy was generally confined to holding his crew together and catching a lot of fish. But he knew that Valentine wanted to draw Miro out, and so he helped put the young man at ease, helped him know that he'd been taken seriously. And it was important for Yacht to be the one who did that, because Valentine had seen, and so had Yacht, how Miro watched him. Yacht might be old, but his arms and legs and back were still those of a fisherman, and every movement revealed the suppleness of his body. Miro even commented on it once, obliquely, admiringly, "You've got the build of a 20-year-old." Valentine heard the ironic corollary that must have been in Miro's mind. "While I, who am young, have the body of an arthritic 90-year-old." So Yacht meant something to Miro. He represented the future that Miro could never have. Admiration and resentment. It would have been hard for Miro to speak openly in front of Yacht if Yacht had not taken care to make sure Miro heard nothing but respect and interest from him. Pleaked, of course, sat in her place, silent, withdrawn, effectively invisible.
"All right," said Miro. "Speculations on the nature of reality and the soul."
"Theology or metaphysics?" asked Valentine.
"Metaphysics, mostly," said Miro. "And physics. Neither one is my specialty, and this isn't the kind of story you said you needed me for."
"I don't always know exactly what I'll need."
"All right," said Miro.
He took a couple of breaths as if he were trying to decide where to begin.
"You know about philotic twining?"
"I know what everybody knows," said Valentine. "And I know that it hasn't led anywhere in the last 2,500 years because it can't really be experimented with." It was an old discovery from the days when scientists were struggling to catch up with technology. Teenage physics students memorized a few wise sayings. "Phylotes are the fundamental building blocks of all matter and energy. Phylotes have neither mass nor inertia. Phylotes have only location, duration, and connection." And everybody knew that it was philotic connections, the twining of philotic rays, that made ansibles work, allowing instantaneous communication between worlds and starships many light years apart. But no one knew why it worked. And because phylotes could not be handled, it was almost impossible to experiment with them. They could only be observed, and then only through their connections.
"Philotics," said Yacht.
"Ansibles."
"A byproduct," said Miro.
"What does it have to do with the soul?" asked Valentine. Miro was about to answer, but he grew frustrated, apparently at the thought of trying to give a long speech through his sluggish, resisting mouth. His jaw was working, his lips moving slightly. Then he said aloud,
"I can't do it."
"We'll listen," said Valentine. She understood his reluctance to try extended discourse with the limitations of his speech, but she also knew he had to do it anyway.
"No," said Miro.
Valentine would have tried further persuasion, but she saw his lips were still moving, though little sound came out. Was he muttering? Cursing? No. She knew it wasn't that at all. It took a moment for her to realize why she was so sure. It was because she had seen Ender do exactly the same thing, moving his lips and jaw, when he was issuing sub-vocalized commands to the computer terminal built into the jewel he wore in his ear. Of course, Miro has the same computer hookup Ender has, so he'll speak to it the same way. In a moment, it became clear what command Miro had given to his jewel. It must have been tied into the ship's computer, because immediately afterward one of the display screens cleared and then showed Miro's face. Only there was none of the slackness that marred his face in person. Valentine realized it was Miro's face as it used to be. And when the computer image spoke, the sound coming from the speakers was surely Miro's voice as it used to be, clear, forceful, intelligent, quick. You know that when phylotes combine to make a durable structure, a meson, a neutron, an atom, a molecule, an organism, a planet, they twine up. What is this? Demanded Yacht. He hadn't yet figured out why the computer was doing the talking. The computer image of Miro froze on the screen and fell silent. Miro himself answered, I've been playing with this, he said. I tell it things and it remembers and speaks for me. Valentine tried to imagine Miro experimenting until the computer program got his face and voice just right. How exhilarating it must have been to recreate himself as he ought to be. And also how agonizing to see what he could have been and know that it could never be real. What a clever idea, said Valentine. Sort of a prosthesis for the personality. Miro laughed, a single ha. Go ahead, said Valentine. Whether you speak for yourself or the computer speaks for you, we'll listen. The computer image came back to life and spoke again in Miro's strong, imaginary voice. Phylotes are the smallest building blocks of matter and energy. They have no mass or dimension. Each phylote connects itself to the rest of the universe along a single ray, a one-dimensional line that connects it to all the other phylotes in its smallest immediate structure, a meson. All those strands from the phylotes in that structure are twined into a single phylotic thread that connects the meson to the next larger structure, a neutron, for instance. The threads in the neutron twine into a yarn connecting it to all the other particles of the atom, and then the yarns of the atom twine into the rope of the molecule. This has nothing to do with nuclear forces or gravity, nothing to do with chemical bonds. As far as we can tell, the phylotic connections don't do anything. They're just there. But the individual rays are always there, present in the twines, said Valentine. Yes, each ray goes on forever, answered the screen. It surprised her, and Yacht too, judging from the way his eyes widened, that the computer was able to respond immediately to what Valentine said. It wasn't just a preset lecture. This had to be a sophisticated program anyway, to simulate Miro's face and voice so well. But now to have it responding as if it were simulating Miro's personality? Or had Miro given some cue to the program? Had he sub-vocalized the response? Valentine didn't know. She had been watching the screen. She would stop doing that now. She would watch Miro himself. We don't know if the ray is infinite, said Valentine. We only know that we haven't found where the ray ends. They twine together, a whole planetful, and each planet's phylotic twine reaches to its star, and each star to the center of the galaxy. And where does the galactic twine go? Said Yacht. It was an old question. School children asked it when they first got into phylotics in high school. Like the old speculation that maybe galaxies were really neutrons or mesons inside a far vaster universe, or the old question, if the universe isn't infinite, what is beyond the edge? Yes, yes, said Miro. This time, though, he spoke from his own mouth. But that's not where I'm going. I want to talk about life. The computerized voice, the voice of the brilliant young man, took over. The phylotic twines from substances like rock or sand all connect directly from each molecule to the center of the planet. But when a molecule is incorporated into a living organism, its ray shifts. Instead of reaching to the planet, it gets twined in with the individual cell. And the rays from the cells are all twined together so that each organism sends a single fiber of phylotic connections to twine up with the central phylotic rope of the planet. Which shows that individual lives have some meaning at the level of physics, said Valentine. She had written an essay about it once, trying to dispel some of the mysticism that had grown up about philotics while at the same time using it to suggest a view of community formation. But there's no practical effect from it, Miro, nothing you can do with it. The philotic twining of living organisms simply is. Every phylode is connected to something, and through that to something else, and through that to something else. Living cells and organisms are simply two of the levels where those connections can be made. Yes, said Miro, that which lives twines. Valentine shrugged, nodded. It probably couldn't be proven, but if Miro wanted that as a premise in his speculations, that was fine. The computer Miro took over again. What I've been thinking about is the endurance of the twining. When a twined structure is broken, as when a molecule breaks apart, the old philotic twining remains for a time. Fragments that are no longer physically joined remain philotically connected for a while. And the smaller the particle, the longer that connection lasts after the breakup of the original structure, and the more slowly the fragments shift to new twinings. Yacht frowned. I thought the smaller things were, the faster things happened. It is counterintuitive, said Valentine. After nuclear fission, it takes hours for the philotic rays to sort themselves back out again, said the computer Miro. Split a particle smaller than an atom, and the philotic connection between the fragments will last much longer than that. Which is how the Ansible works, said Miro. Valentine looked at him closely. Why was he talking sometimes in his own voice, sometimes through the computer? Was the program under his control, or wasn't it? The principle of the Ansible is that if you suspend a meson in a powerful magnetic field, said computer Miro, split it, and carry the two parts as far away as you want, the philotic twining will still connect them. And the connection is instantaneous. If one fragment spins or vibrates, the ray between them spins and vibrates, and the movement is detectable at the other end at exactly the same moment. It takes no time whatsoever for the movement to be transmitted along the entire length of the ray, even if the two fragments are carried light years away from each other. Nobody knows why it works, but we're glad it does. Without the Ansible, there'd be no possibility of meaningful communication between human worlds.
Hell, there's no meaningful communication now, said Yacht. And if it wasn't for the Ansibles, there'd be no warfleet heading for Lusitania right now.
Valentine wasn't listening to Yacht, though. She was watching Miro. This time, Valentine saw when he moved his lips and jaw, slightly, silently. Sure enough, after he subvocalized, the computer image of Miro spoke again. He was giving commands. It had been absurd for her to think otherwise. Who else could be controlling the computer? It's a hierarchy, said the image. The more complex the structure, the faster the response to change. It's as if the smaller the particle is, the stupider it is. So it's slower to pick up on the fact that it's now part of a different structure. Well, now you're anthropomorphizing, said Valentine.
Maybe, said Miro. Maybe not.
Human beings are organisms, said the image. But human philotic twinings go way beyond those of any other life form.
Well, now you're talking about that stuff that came from Ganges 1,000 years ago, said Valentine. Nobody's been able to get consistent results from those experiments.
The researchers, Hindus all and devout ones, claimed that they had shown that human philotic twinings, unlike those of other organisms, did not always reach directly down into the planet's core to twine with all other life and matter. Rather, they claimed, the philotic rays from human beings often twined with those of other human beings, most often with families, but sometimes between teachers and students, and sometimes between close co-workers, including the researchers themselves. The Gangians had concluded that this distinction between humans and other plant and animal life proved that the souls of some humans were literally lifted to a higher plane, nearer to perfection. They believed that the perfecting ones had become one with each other the way that all of life was one with the world.
It's all very pleasingly mystical, but nobody except Ganges and Hindus takes it seriously anymore.
I do, said Miro. To each his own, said Yacht. Not as a religion, said Miro. As science.
You mean metaphysics, don't you? Said Valentine. It was the Miro image that answered.
The philotic connections between people change fastest of all, and what the Gangians proved is that they respond to human will. If you have strong feelings binding you to your family, then your philotic rays will twine, and you will be one, in exactly the same way that the different atoms in a molecule are one.
It was a sweet idea. She had thought so when she first heard it, perhaps 2,000 years ago, when Ender was speaking for a murdered revolutionary on Mindanao. She and Ender had speculated then on whether the Gangian tests would show that they were twined, as brother and sister. They wondered whether there had been such a connection between them as children, and if it had persisted when Ender was taken off to battle school and they were separated for 6 years. Ender had liked that idea very much, and so had Valentine. But after that one conversation, the subject never came up again. The notion of philotic connections between people had remained in the pretty idea category in her memory.
It's nice to think that the metaphor of human unity might have a physical analog, said Valentine.
Listen, said Miro.
Apparently he didn't want her to dismiss the idea as nice. Again his image spoke for him. If the Gangians are right, then when a human being chooses to bond with another person, when he makes a commitment to a community, it is not just a social phenomenon, it's a physical event as well. The phylote, the smallest conceivable physical particle, if we can call something with no mass or inertia physical at all, responds to an act of the human will.
Well, that's why it's so hard for anyone to take the Gangian experiment seriously.
The Gangian experiments were careful and honest, but no one else ever got the same results. No one else ever took them seriously enough to perform the same experiments. Does that surprise you?
Yes, said Valentine. But then she remembered how the idea had been ridiculed in the scientific press, while it was immediately picked up by the lunatic fringe and incorporated into dozens of fringe religions. Once that happened, how could a scientist hope to get funding for such a project? How could a scientist expect to have a career if others came to think of him as a proponent of a metaphysical religion?
No, I suppose it doesn't. The Miro image nodded. If the philotic ray twines in response to the human will, why couldn't we suppose that all philotic twining is willed? Every particle, all of matter and energy, why couldn't every observable phenomenon in the universe be the willing behavior of individuals?
Now we're beyond Gangian Hinduism, said Valentine. How seriously am I supposed to take this? What you're talking about is animism, the most primitive kind of religion. Everything's alive, stones and oceans and...
No, said Miro.
Life is life.
Life is life, said the computer program. Life is when a single phylote has the strength of will to bind together the molecules of a single cell, to entwine their rays into one. A stronger phylote can bind together many cells into a single organism. The strongest of all are the intelligent beings. We can bestow our phylotic connections where we will. The philotic basis of intelligent life is even clearer in the other known sentient species. When a pecanino dies and passes into the third life, it's his strong-willed phylote that preserves his identity and passes it from the mammaloid corpse to the living tree.
Reincarnation, said Yacht. The phylote is the soul.
It happens with the piggies, anyway, said Miro.
The hive queen as well, said the Miro image.
The reason we discovered philotic connections in the first place was because we saw how the buggers communicated with each other faster than light. That's what showed us it was possible. The individual buggers are all part of the hive queen. They're like her hands and feet, and she's their mind. one vast organism with thousands or millions of bodies, and the only connection between them is the twining of their phallotic rays. It was a picture of the universe that Valentine had never conceived of before. Of course, as a historian and biographer, she usually conceived of things in terms of peoples and societies. While she wasn't ignorant of physics, neither was she deeply trained in it. Perhaps a physicist would know at once why this whole idea was absurd. But then perhaps a physicist would be so locked into the consensus of his scientific community that it would be harder for him to accept an idea that transformed the meaning of everything he knew, even if it were true. And she liked the idea well enough to wish it were true. Of the trillion lovers who had whispered to each other, "We are one," could it be that some of them really were? Of the billions of families who had bonded together so closely they felt like a single soul, wouldn't it be lovely to think that at the most basic level of reality it was so? Jacht, however, was not so caught up in the idea.
"I thought we weren't supposed to talk about the existence of the Hive Queen," he said. "I thought that was Ender's secret."
"It's all right," said Valentine. "Everyone in this room knows." Jacht gave her his impatient look.
"I thought we were coming to Lusitania to help in the struggle against Starve's Congress. What does any of this have to do with the real world?"
"Well, maybe nothing," said Valentine. "Maybe everything."
Jacht buried his face in his hands for a moment, then looked back up at her with a smile that wasn't really a smile.
"I haven't heard you say anything so transcendental since your brother left Trondheim."
That stung her, particularly because she knew it was meant to. After all these years, was Jacht still jealous of her connection with Ender? Did he still resent the fact that she could care about things that meant nothing to him?
"When he went," said Valentine, "I stayed."
She was really saying, "I passed the only test that mattered. Why should you doubt me now?" Jacht was abashed. It was one of the best things about him, that when he realized he was wrong, he backed down at once.
"And when you went," said Jacht, "I came with you."
Which she took to mean, "I'm with you, I'm really not jealous of Ender anymore, and I'm sorry for sniping at you." Later, when they were alone, they'd say these things again openly. It wouldn't do to reach Lusitania with suspicions and jealousy on either's part. Miro, of course, was oblivious to the fact that Jacht and Valentine had already declared a truce. He was only aware of the tension between them and thought he was the cause of it.
"I'm sorry," said Miro. "I didn't mean to..."
"It's all right," said Jacht. "I was out of line."
"There is no line," said Valentine, with a smile at her husband. Jacht smiled back. That was what Miro needed to see. He visibly relaxed. "Go on," said Valentine.
"Take all that as a given," said the Miro image. Valentine couldn't help it. She laughed out loud. Partly she laughed because this mystical, Gangian, Philote as soul business was such an absurdly large premise to swallow. Partly she laughed to release the tension between her and Jacht.
"I'm sorry," she said. "That's an awfully big given. If that's the preamble, I can't wait to hear the conclusion."
Miro, understanding her laughter now, smiled back. "I've had a lot of time to think," he said. "That really was my speculation on what life is. That everything in the universe is behavior. But there's something else we want to tell you about. And ask you about, too, I guess."
He turned to Jacht.
"And it has a lot to do with stopping the Lusitania fleet."
Jacht smiled and nodded.
"I appreciate being tossed a bone now and then."
Valentine smiled her most charming smile. "So, later you'll be glad when I break a few bones." Jacht laughed again.
"Go on, Miro," said Valentine. It was the image Miro that responded. "If all of reality is the behavior of Philotes,
then obviously most Vylotes are only smart enough or strong enough to act as a meson or hold together a neutron. A very few of them have the strength of will to be alive, to govern an organism. And a tiny, tiny fraction of them are powerful enough to control, no, to be, a sentient organism. But still, the most complex and intelligent being, the Hive Queen, for instance, is, at core, just a phylote, like all the others. It gains its identity and life from the particular role it happens to fulfill, but what it is a phylote. Myself, my will is a subatomic particle? Asked Valentine. Yacht smiled, nodded. A fun idea, he said. My Shu and I are brothers.
Miro smiled wanly.
The Miro image, however, answered. If a star and a hydrogen atom are brothers, then yes, there is a kinship between you and the phylotes that make up common objects like your shoe.
Valentine noticed that Miro had not subvocalized anything just before the Miro image answered. How had the software producing the Miro image come up with the analogy with stars and hydrogen atoms if Miro didn't provide it on the spot? Valentine had never heard of a computer program capable of producing such involved yet appropriate conversation on its own.
And maybe there are other kinships in the universe that you know nothing of till now, said the Miro image. Maybe there's a kind of life you haven't met.
Valentine, watching Miro, saw that he seemed worried, agitated, as if he didn't like what the Miro image was doing now.
What kind of life are you talking about? Asked Yacht.
There's a physical phenomenon in the universe, a very common one, that is completely unexplained, and yet everyone takes it for granted, and no one has seriously investigated why and how it happens. This is it. None of the Ansible connections has ever broken.
Nonsense, said Yacht. One of the Ansibles on Trondheim was out of service for 6 months last year. It doesn't happen often, but it happens.
Again Miro's lips and jaw were motionless. Again the image answered immediately. Clearly he was not controlling it now.
I didn't say that the Ansibles never break down. I said that the connections, the phylotic twining between the parts of a split meson, have never broken. The machinery of the Ansible can break down, the software can get corrupted, but never has a meson fragment within an Ansible made the shift to allow its phylotic ray to entwine with another local meson or even with the nearby planet.
The magnetic field suspends the fragment, of course, said Yacht.
Split mesons don't endure long enough in nature for us to know how they naturally act, said Valentine. I know all the standard answers, said the image. All nonsense. All the kind of answers parents give their children when they don't know the truth and don't want to bother finding out. People still treat the Ansibles like magic. Everybody's glad enough that the Ansibles keep on working. If they tried to figure out why, the magic might go out of it, and then the Ansibles would stop.
Nobody feels that way, said Valentine.
They all do, said the image. Even if it took hundreds of years, or 1,000 years, or 3,000 years, one of those connections should have broken by now. One of those meson fragments should have shifted its phylotic ray, but they never have.
Why? Asked Miro. Valentine assumed at first that Miro was asking a rhetorical question. But no, he was looking at the image just like the rest of them, asking it to tell him why. I thought this program was reporting your speculations, said Valentine.
It was, said Miro, but not now. What if there's a being who lives among the phylotic connections between Ansibles? Asked the image. Are you sure you want to do this? Asked Miro. Again he was speaking to the image on the screen, and the image on the screen changed to the face of a young woman, one that Valentine had never seen before.
What if there's a being who dwells in the web of philotic rays connecting the Ansibles on every world and every starship in the human universe? What if she is composed of those philotic connections? What if her thoughts take place in the spin and vibration of the split pairs? What if her memories are stored in the computers of every world and every ship? Who are you? Asked Valentine, speaking directly to the image. Maybe I'm the one who keeps all those philotic connections alive, Ansible to Ansible. Maybe I'm a new kind of organism, one that doesn't twine rays together, but instead keeps them twined to each other so that they never break apart. And if that's true, then if those connections ever broke, if the Ansibles ever stopped moving, if the Ansibles ever fell silent, then I would die. Who are you? Asked Valentine again. Valentine, I'd like you to meet Jane, said Miro. Ender's friend and mine. Jane. So Jane wasn't the code name of a subversive group within the Starways Congress bureaucracy. Jane was a computer program. A piece of software. No. If what she had just suggested was true, then Jane was more than a program. She was a being who dwelt in the web of philotic rays, who stored her memories in the computers of every world. If she was right, then the philotic web, the network of crisscrossing philotic rays that connected Ansible to Ansible on every world, was her body, her substance. And the philotic links continued working with never a breakdown because she willed it so. So now I ask the great Demosthenes, said Jane. Am I Raman or Varelsa? Am I alive at all? I need your answer, because I think I can stop the Lusitania fleet. But before I do, I have to know, is it a cause worth dying for?
Jane's words cut Miro to the heart. She could stop the fleet. He could see that at once. Congress had sent the MD device with several ships of the fleet, but they had not yet sent the order to use it. They couldn't send the order without Jane knowing it beforehand, and with her complete penetration of all the Ansible communications, she could intercept the order before it was sent. The trouble was that she couldn't do it without Congress realizing that she existed, or at least that something was wrong. If the fleet didn't confirm the order, it would simply be sent again and again and again. The more she blocked the messages, the clearer it would be to Congress that someone had an impossible degree of control over the Ansible computers. She might avoid this by sending a counterfeit confirmation, but then she would have to monitor all the communications between the ships of the fleet and between the fleet and all planetside stations in order to keep up the pretense that the fleet knew something about the kill order. Despite Jane's enormous abilities, this would soon be beyond her. She could pay some degree of attention to hundreds, even thousands of things at a time, but it didn't take Miro long to realize that there was no way she could handle all the monitoring and alterations this would take, even if she did nothing else. One way or another, the secret would be out. And as Jane explained her plan, Miro knew that she was right. Her best option, the one with the least chance of revealing her existence, was simply to cut off all Ansible communications between the fleet and the planetside stations, and between the ships of the fleet. Let each ship remain isolated, the crew wondering what had happened, and they would have no choice but to abort their mission or continue to obey their original orders. Either they would go away, or they would arrive at Lusitania without the authority to use the Little Doctor. In the meantime, however, Congress would know that something had happened. It was possible that with Congress's normal bureaucratic inefficiency, no one would ever figure out what happened. But eventually, somebody would realize that there was no natural or human explanation of what happened. Someone would realize that Jane, or something like her, must exist, and that cutting off Ansible communications would destroy her. Once they knew this, she would surely die. Maybe not. Miro insisted. Maybe you can keep them from acting. interfere with interplanetary communications, so they can't give the order to shut down communications. No one answered. He knew why. She couldn't interfere with Ansible communications forever. Eventually, the government on each planet would reach the conclusion on its own. She might live on in constant warfare for years, decades, generations. But the more power she used, the more humankind would hate and fear her. Eventually, she would be killed.
A book, then, said Miro. Like the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, like the life of human. The speaker for the dead could write it to persuade them not to do it.
Maybe, said Valentine.
She can't die, said Miro.
I know that we can't ask her to take that chance, said Valentine, but if it's the only way to save the Hive Queen and the Pequeninos... Miro was furious.
You can talk about her dying. What is Jane to you? A program, a piece of software. But she's not. She's real. She's as real as the Hive Queen. She's as real as any of the piggies.
More real to you, I think, said Valentine.
As real, said Miro. You forget. I know the piggies like my own brothers.
But you're able to contemplate the possibility that destroying them may be morally necessary.
Don't twist my words.
I'm untwisting them, said Valentine. You can contemplate losing them, because they're already lost to you. Losing Jane, though.
Because she's my friend, does that mean I can't plead for her? Can life and death decisions only be made by strangers?
Yacht's voice, quiet and deep, interrupted the argument.
Calm down, both of you. It isn't your decision.
It's Jane's.
She has the right to determine the value of her own life. I'm no philosopher, but I know that.
Well said, Valentine answered. Miro knew that Yacht was right, that it was Jane's choice. But he couldn't bear that because he also knew what she would decide. Leaving the choice up to Jane was identical to asking her to do it. And yet in the end, the choice would be up to her anyway. He didn't even have to ask her what she would decide. Time passed so quickly for her, especially since they were already traveling at near light speed, that she had probably decided already. It was too much to bear. To lose Jane now would be unbearable. Just thinking of it threatened Miro's composure. He didn't want to show such weakness in front of these people. Good people. They were good people, but he didn't want them to see him lose control of himself. So Miro leaned forward, found his balance, and precariously lifted himself from his seat. It was hard, since only a few of his muscles responded to his will, and it took all his concentration just to walk from the bridge to his compartment. No one followed him or even spoke to him. He was glad of that. Alone in his room, he lay down on his bunk and called to her, but not aloud. He sub-vocalized, because that was his custom when he talked to her. Even though the others on this ship now knew of her existence, he had no intention of losing the habits that had kept her concealed till now. Jane, he said silently. Yes, said the voice in his ear. He imagined, as always, that her soft voice came from a woman just out of sight, but close, very close. He shut his eyes so he could imagine her better, her breath on his cheek. Her hair dangling over his face as she spoke to him softly, as he answered in silence. Talk to Ender before you decide, he said.
I already did. Just now, while you were thinking about this.
What did he say?
To do nothing. To decide nothing until the order is actually sent.
That's right. Maybe they won't do it.
Maybe.
Maybe a new group with different policies will come into power. Maybe this group will change its mind. Maybe Valentine's propaganda will succeed. Maybe there'll be a mutiny on the fleet. This last was so unlikely that Miro realized Jane absolutely believed that the order would be sent. How soon? Asked Miro.
The fleet should arrive in about 15 years, a year or less after these two ships get there. That's how I timed your voyage. The order will be sent sometime before.
Maybe 6 months before arrival, which would be about 8 hours ship's time before the fleet drops out of light speed and staggers down to normal speeds.
Don't do it, said Miro. I haven't decided.
Yes, you have. You've decided to do it. She said nothing.
Don't leave me, he said. I don't leave my friends if I don't have to, she said. Some people do, but I don't. Just don't, he said again. He was crying. Could she see that, sense it somehow through the jewel in his ear? I'll try.
Find another way. Find another way to stop them. Find some way to put yourself outside the philotic net so they can't kill you.
That's what Ender said.
Then do it.
I can search for such a way, but who knows if it exists?
It has to.
This is why I wonder sometimes whether I'm alive or not. You living creatures, you think that because you want something very much, it has to happen. That wishing something with all your heart will make it so.
How can you search for something if you don't believe that it exists?
Either I search or I don't, said Jane. I don't get distracted or bored like humans do. I'll try to think of something else.
Think of this too, said Miro. Think of who you are, of how your mind works. You can't possibly find a way of saving your life until you understand how you came to life in the first place. And once you understand yourself, then maybe I can make a copy and store it somewhere.
Maybe. Maybe, she echoed. But he knew she didn't believe it, and neither did he. She existed in the philotic network of the Ansibles. She could store her memories in the network of computers on every world and every ship in space, but there was nowhere that she could put herself, not if it required a network of philotic links. Unless.
What about the father trees on Lusitania? They communicate philotically, don't they?
It's not the same thing, said Jane. It isn't digital. It isn't coded the way the Ansibles are.
It may not be digital, but the information gets transferred somehow. It works philotically, and the Hive Queen, too. She communicates with the buggers that way.
No chance of that, said Jane. The structure's too simple. Her communication with them isn't a network. They're all connected only to her.
How do you know it won't work when you don't even know for sure how you function?
All right, I'll think about it.
Think hard, he said.
I only know one way to think, said Jane.
I mean pay attention to it.
She could follow many trains of thought at once, but her thoughts were prioritized with many different levels of attention.
Mito didn't want her relegating her self-investigation to some low order of attention.
I'll pay attention, she said.
Then you'll think of something, he said. You will.
She didn't answer for a while. He thought this meant that the conversation was over. His thoughts began to wander, to try to imagine what life would be like, still in this body, only without Jane. It could happen before he even arrived on Lusitania. And if it did, this voyage would have been the most terrible mistake of his life. By traveling at light speed, he was skipping 30 years of real time, 30 years that might have been spent with Jane. He might be able to deal with losing her then, but losing her now, only a few weeks into knowing her. He knew that his tears arose from self-pity, but he shed them all the same.
Miro,
she said.
What?
He asked.
How can I think of something that's never been thought of before?
For a moment, he didn't understand.
Miro, how can I figure out something that isn't just the logical conclusion of things that human beings have already figured out and written somewhere?
You think of things all the time, said Miro.
I'm trying to conceive of something inconceivable. I'm trying to find answers to questions that human beings have never even tried to ask.
Can't you do that?
If I can't think original thoughts, does that mean that I'm nothing but a computer program that got out of hand?
Hell, Jane, most people never have an original thought in their lives.
He laughed softly.
Does that mean that they're just ground-dwelling apes that got out of hand?
You were crying, she said.
Yes.
You don't think I can think of a way out of this. You think I'm going to die.
I believe you can think of a way. I really do, but that doesn't stop me from being afraid.
Afraid that I'll die.
Afraid that I'll lose you.
Would that be so terrible? To lose me?
Oh, God!
he whispered. "Would you miss me for an hour?" she insisted. "For a day? For a year?" What did she want from him? Assurance that when she was gone, she'd be remembered? That someone would yearn for her? Why would she doubt that? Didn't she know him yet? Maybe she was human enough that she simply needed reassurance of things she already knew. "Forever," he said. It was her turn to laugh, playfully.
"You won't live that long," she said.
"Now you tell me," he said. This time when she fell silent, she didn't come back, and Miro was left alone with his thoughts.
Valentine Jagd and Plicht had remained together on the bridge, talking through the things they had learned, trying to decide what they might mean, what might happen. The only conclusion they reached was that while the future couldn't be known, it would probably be a good deal better than their worst fears and nowhere near as good as their best hopes. Wasn't that how the world always worked? "Yes," said Plicht, "except for the exceptions." That was Plicht's way. Except when she was teaching, she said little, but when she did speak, it had a way of ending the conversation. Plicht got up to leave the bridge, headed for her miserably uncomfortable bed. As usual, Valentine tried to persuade her to go back to the other starship. "Varsam and Ro don't want me in their room," said Plicht. "Oh, they don't mind a bit."
"Valentine," said Jagd, "Plicht doesn't want to go back to the other ship because she doesn't want to miss anything."
"Oh," said Valentine. Plicht grinned. "Good night." Soon after, Jagd also left the bridge. His hand rested on Valentine's shoulder for a moment as he left. "I'll be there soon," she said. And she meant it at the moment, meant to follow him almost at once. Instead, she remained on the bridge, thinking, brooding, trying to make sense of a universe that would put all the non-human species ever known to man at risk of extinction, all at once. The Hive Queen, the Pecaninos, and now Jane, the only one of her kind, perhaps the only one that ever could exist. A veritable profusion of intelligent life, and yet known only to a few, and all of them in line to be snuffed out. At least Ender will realize at last that this is the natural order of things, that he might not be as responsible for the destruction of the buggers 3,000 years ago as he had always thought. Xenocide must be built into the universe. No mercy, not even for the greatest players in the game. How could she have ever thought otherwise? Why should intelligent species be immune to the threat of extinction that looms over every species that ever came to be? It must have been an hour after Jagd left the bridge, before Valentine finally turned off her terminal and stood up to go to bed. On a whim, though, she paused before leaving and spoke into the air. "Jane," she said. "Jane?" No answer. There was no reason for her to expect one. It was Miro who wore the jewel in his ear. Miro and Ender both. How many people did she think Jane could monitor at one time? Maybe 2 was the most she could handle. Or maybe 2,000. Or 2,000,000. What did Valentine know of the limitations of a being who existed as a phantom in the philotic web? Even if Jane heard her, Valentine had no right to expect that she would answer her call. Valentine stopped in the corridor, directly between Miro's door and the door to the room she shared with Jagd. The doors were not soundproof. She could hear Jagd's soft snoring inside their compartment. She also heard another sound, Miro's breath. He wasn't sleeping. He might be crying. She hadn't raised 3 children without being able to recognize that ragged, heavy breathing. "He's not my child. I shouldn't meddle." She pushed open the door. It was noiseless, but it cast a shaft of light across the bed. Miro's crying stopped immediately, but he looked at her through swollen eyes. "What do you want?" he said. She stepped into the room and sat on the floor beside his bunk, so their faces were only a few inches apart. "You've never cried for yourself, have you?" she said. A few times. But tonight you're crying for her.
Myself, as much as her.
Valentine leaned closer, put her arm around him, pulled his head onto her shoulder.
No,
he said. But he didn't pull away. After a few moments, his arm swung awkwardly around to embrace her. He didn't cry anymore, but he did let her hold him for a minute or two. Maybe it helped. Valentine had no way of knowing. Then he was done. He pulled away, rolled onto his back.
I'm sorry, he said.
You're welcome, she said. She believed in answering what people meant, not what they said.
Don't tell Yacht, he whispered.
Nothing to tell, she said. We had a good talk. She got up and left, closing his door behind her. He was a good boy. She liked the fact that he could admit caring what Yacht thought about him. And what did it matter if his tears tonight had self-pity in them? She had shed a few like that herself. Grief, she reminded herself, is almost always for the mourner's loss.